Hello, hello, hello. Jackie Fox here in Dublin, Sean Whelan in Washington, D.C. And welcome to Adam Maguire from our business desk. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Jackie. How are you? Hi, Sean.
How you doing, Adam?
Well, gentlemen, Donald Trump's White House is taking shape. And during our last episode, Sean, we were talking about efforts to stop the clown car coming to town. Not exactly the clown car, more the wrestling ring.
Yeah, the wrestling ring. Everybody knows wrestling. Everybody loves wrestling. Well, they do in bits of America, that's for sure. And even bits of Ireland. I've seen some of these wrestling shows packing out the Point Theatre, as we now call it. The Point Depot, as it used to be in the good old days.
The Three Arena, Sean, you're missing out. My God.
Is Three still a thing? Anyway, sorry, I can't keep up with these sponsorship changes and name changes. Of course, you have a big name change coming up as President of the United States later, but he's already been posting various people to cabinet positions or nominating them anyway. One of them is Linda McMahon, who is one of the founders of WWE, which is one of the wrestling franchises, and became famous for not only being a business executive, but also taking part in the ring and the show that surrounded it from time to time. So she has now got a job in the administration in education and a department that he wants to shut down.
Yeah.
The federal department, that is, and return education to the states. But it's, to mix metaphors, it's not her first rodeo. She also served in the first Trump administration as small business secretary, because WWE is, folks, a small business.
You know, I feel like if you told me over 20 years ago while watching WWE that 20 years later I'd be talking about people like The Undertaker, Kane, Hulk Hogan, all involved in Republican politics. And now, as you say, Sean, Linda McMahon nominated for education secretary. I wouldn't have believed you. And it's just baffling how just some worlds collide. Were you a wrestling fan, Adam?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Massive wrestling fan. Back in the days of Bret the Hitman Hart and The Undertaker. So really strange to see him being involved in the election process for Trump and Hulk Hogan, of course, as well. But it makes you wonder what, like, I mean, Linda McMahon was not only the president and then CEO of WWE, she was a character on the show as well, and some very bizarre plot lines over the years as well. It makes you wonder, though, are there some other wrestlers there who could maybe take cabinet positions or be part of the Trump administration? There was Irwin Orr Scheister, or IRS, was a wrestler. He could be maybe take a role in the Treasury. You could, Sergeant Slaughter could go to defense. Ric Flair was the Nature Boy, so maybe agriculture could be a place for him. So yeah. Maybe we could pack the whole cabinet with wrestlers.
Brilliant. And the more you deep dive into this as well, the more crossover you realise Donald Trump had with the wrestling world. You know, Donald Trump, he's a WWE Hall of Famer since 2013, and he also appeared in the ring.
Yeah, he popped up on the show a few times, and I recently watched the documentary, the Mr. McMahon documentary, and he features in that. There was one ongoing plot line where he had a bet against Vince McMahon, who was head of the WWE for a long, long time, and the loser of the bet had to shave their head, and of course Vince McMahon was the one who lost that bet and had to shave his head in the end. But yeah, Trump being a character in the WWE for a long, long time.
He's also been associated, though, with MMA, and Dana White, who's the boss of that, was one of the people in that photograph. Most people pointed at Elon Musk as being the he isn't part of the Trump family down in Mar-a-Lago the night after the electoral victory for Donald Trump. But Dana White has been involved in a lot of events involving Donald Trump, and had him coming into Madison Square Garden a couple of times, including one night after he'd had a particularly bad day in court during one of his criminal trials. So, watch that space. MMA perhaps taking over in the popularity stakes from wrestling, and MMA getting a little more political. No sign of any cabinet posts for Dana White. But he could have some future role in the administration. By no means all the jobs have been filled. It's about 4,000 positions have to get filled when an administration changes. Mm-hmm. And of course, Dana White, in something of a symbiotic relationship in building up MMA with another famous individual from the ring or the octagon, and that is Conor McGregor, who's been in the news lately.
Because UFC and wrestling, it was all part of Donald Trump's election campaign. because he did have that brilliant podcast strategy, which saw him appear on numerous UFC podcasts and wrestling podcasts. He went on 6 Feet Under, the podcast hosted by former wrestler The Undertaker.
It's an honor to do the show with you guys.
That's sir, I that means a lot to us and giving us this opportunity. You know, we're not journalists. And
I turned down 60 Minutes and I'm doing your stupid show.
Yeah, we're doing you're doing a professional wrestling podcast.
Yeah, hey,
that's all right.
We're not journalists and we're really not that great podcasters either, but we get people that watch us.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a lot of overlap between wrestlers and the Republican Party. Linda McMahon previously ran a couple of Senate campaigns for the Republican Party. And of course, the famous Joe Rogan interview. Joe Rogan, a massive link to MMA there as well. So he definitely tapped into that market and that audience as part of his election campaign.
Well, listen, Royal Rumbles in wrestling are all about eliminating your competitors by tossing them over the top rope. And it seems that's what Donald Trump wants to do with many countries during his presidency, including Ireland. Adam, sorry now, but you're not really here to talk about wrestling. You're
what
here,
a shame.
I'm sorry, but you're here to talk about why people are sounding the alarm bells in Ireland about a second Trump presidency and what that means for Ireland. Because there is all of this talk about the corporate tax rate. Just explain to us what exactly that is and why we keep hearing about it.
Yeah, so the corporation tax is a tax that's applied to a company's profits. So, you know, after they've sold their goods or services and paid for their materials and their staff and all that other stuff, whatever is left is their profit, and that's what's subject to corporation tax. And the rate is the percentage of that profit that then has to be paid in tax. So in Ireland at the moment, the corporation tax rate for bigger firms is 15%. It used to, of course, be 12.5%. It still is for smaller businesses, but it was raised to 15% for bigger firms as part of a global agreement that tried to discourage companies from moving their money around to get the lowest tax rate possible. And that's actually part of the reason why we're enjoying bumper corporation tax take in Ireland at the moment, because big firms are paying more than they were before. And at the same time, their profits are also booming. So a bigger chunk of cash there to be taxed. In the USA at the moment, and this is the key thing, the corporation tax rate is 21%. It was 35% a few years ago. Trump, though, cut it to 21% during his first term. Now he's talking about bringing it down to that lowest possible rate of 15%, which would match what we have in Ireland.
So Donald Trump, he wants to basically incentivize industries to bring them back to the United States and bring that production back to the United States. Mm. And part of that plan is to slash the corporate tax rate to Irish levels. Now, that might be damaging to Ireland's decades-old model of attracting jobs and those tax dollars from US multinationals. And I was quite struck by a recent figure, Adam, that the US-owned foreign multinationals employ about 11% of Irish workers. Yeah. And just three big US companies account for about 1 in every 8 euro of tax collected in Ireland. And there was that massive jump in corporate tax revenue from 4.6 billion in 2014 to around 30 billion this year. So if Donald Trump reduces that to 15%, that tax rate to 15%, to try and get those American companies back, how does that affect Ireland's finances?
Yeah, well, if the US rate is also 15%, suddenly there's less of an incentive on these companies to book their profits through Ireland when they just pay the same rate if they booked them through their headquarters in the US. In reality, though, it's not necessarily that straightforward, because over the years, successive governments have attached various bells and whistles onto the corporation tax rate to kind of make it more attractive. So things like a tax credit for research and development conducted here, or knowledge development box, which encourages companies to put their intellectual property into their Irish operations. So even if the corporation tax rates are equal, there might still be a bit of an advantage in booking those international profits through Dublin. And there's also the fact that these companies do need to have sizable operations in Europe. It's not just about low taxes. You know, whatever the rate, they'll still need people working here or somewhere in Europe on customer support, translations, legal admin roles, engineers working on the likes of data centers. So, you know, really, if a company already has made a big investment here and built up a big presence, it's unlikely they'll suddenly abandon that just because the same rate of tax applies in the US. What they might do, however, is it might become less attractive for them to expand their operations in the future, or it might delay new companies from setting up international operations in Ireland, or maybe their future presence here would be smaller than it otherwise might have been if the tax rate was different.
So really, you know, if a company already has made a big investment here and built up a big presence, it's unlikely that, you know, they'll abandon that just to pay the same tax rate basically in the US.
Yeah, probably not. I said it might slow them on future investments, but there is one kind of complicating factor in all of this when the lower corporation tax rate is combined with the threat of tariffs, because Trump has, of course, indicated that he also plans to bring in a kind of default 10% tariff on all imports and higher again if it's coming from China. And the problem there is that many of the big US multinationals that employ thousands of people here in Ireland are making products that then get shipped to the US. That's particularly true in the area of pharmaceuticals and chemicals. If you look at the export figures last year, just under half of Ireland's exports to the US at $25.5 billion worth, or euro worth, were medical and pharmaceutical goods.
Wow.
A further $10.8 billion were organic chemicals. So if those products are treated as Irish when they get to the US and then a 10% tariff is applied to them, suddenly the benefit of making them here starts to fade away. And those companies may decide that they're going to switch that production that's for the US anyway back to US factories. Now, obviously, it's never really that straightforward because, you know, they'd have to look at their supply chains and whether moving production to the US would mean they're paying tariffs on components that they need to import that they're already getting here and so on. But if they were to shift production, if they were to do that and bring it back to the US, it means they don't book the sales from them here, which means lower corporation tax take. They don't need as many employees here, of course, which could potentially lead to a spike in unemployment. That means higher social welfare costs. And at the same time, you have fewer people paying income tax, maybe not spending as much in the economy either on VAT as well. So potentially that's where you see a huge economic impact on Ireland.
Adam, I'm interested in your take on Howard Lutnick, who has been nominated as Commerce Secretary and who would be one of the people who would be in the trenches here on this issue of the trade relationship between Ireland, the European Union generally, and all of those other countries, Canada and Mexico, of course, feeling the lash this very morning from the Trump proposals. Lutnick is not a government worker. He's a billionaire investor type, but he's been a strong supporter of Trump on the issue of tariffs. He's also had a few digs at Ireland, saying it nonsense that Ireland runs a trade surplus with the United States. And that's exactly what you were talking about. Those are US firms manufacturing in Ireland or using some of their manufactured capacity in Ireland to trade back to the United States.
Let's go over what Apple does right now. This is a simple example. They make the parts in China.
Yeah.
They put the parts together in Taiwan. Then they wave their magic wand and it floats over Ireland. Of course it floats over Ireland because that's where Apple does its products. And then it comes to America and they make, I don't know, something like 3% profit in America. They pay corporate tax on 3% profit in America. And Ireland announces a massive budget surplus for their 5 million people. Ha.
So this,
it's just not true. So the concept is have them pay their taxes in America, and that is how you fix America.
But of course, trade is not quite as simple as most of us think it is it?
No, absolutely. And I suppose this will be the worry for the Irish government is that Ireland has been specifically called out by Howard Lutnick in a tweet back in mid-October before the election, of course. He tweeted out, as you say, saying it was nonsense that Ireland ran a trade surplus with the US. So effectively, Ireland is selling more to the US than we're buying from them. And it is a big surplus as well. You know, we sold last year 54.5 billion euro worth of goods to the US. We bought in 22.8 billion euro worth of goods from them. So that's a trade surplus of 31.7 billion euro. So big, big gap there. And, you know, as I say, a huge chunk of that is because of pharmaceuticals and chemicals and medical products and so on. And Lutnick, if he's Commerce Secretary, he will be tasked with promoting US businesses and industries. You know, he'd be very keen by hook or by crook to get those products back into American factories instead of having them made in Ireland and shipped back to the US instead.
Trade is a two-way street. I mean, you almost hope that a country the size of Ireland, 5.2 million, would be running a trade surplus with a country of 330 million people. And there's no way you're going to balance up the trade unless you reduce it to an incredibly low level. But also, don't forget, stuff does come from Ireland, that 22 billion, but also investment, which is a far bigger driver of the EU-US relationship than trade is. Ireland is apparently the ninth biggest foreign investor into the United States and employs about 130 million people directly in Irish-owned companies are employed here in the United States. So it's not a one-way street at all. And I think it's worth making that point.
Yeah, because Donald Trump, he's promised 10% tariffs on goods coming into the US from the likes of Ireland. Adam, can you tell us what are the most popular Irish goods in the US and how would they be affected?
Yeah, well, if we put aside those pharmaceutical goods and all that other stuff, there's a couple of sectors that would be heavily affected. Dairy is a massive Irish export to the US. Dairy exports to the US worth €681 million last year. Demand from the US accounting for really a huge amount of the growth that's been seen in the dairy sector in Ireland in recent years. Apparently last year, nearly a quarter of all Irish butter exports went to the US. Kerrygold having a particularly strong brand over there. I think it's the biggest non-American butter brand in the US. So
well,
really big.
People might remember putting Kerrygold in their coffee in the US. Remember that whole fad and that whole trend?
Yeah. Bulletproof coffee, which is a terrible idea, that would give you all this energy and, you know, make you so healthy and so on. Yeah, a really terrible idea, but good for Kerrygold. And you know, they have such an amazing reputation in the US. You know, I watch a lot of baking videos on YouTube. And when the Americans there are telling their viewers to get a good quality butter, they're almost always saying, get Kerrygold or something like Kerrygold. Yeah. You know, they're amazed by the fact that this stuff is coming from grass-fed cows, which is something we here in Ireland probably take for granted. Another thing Americans rave about from Ireland is, of course, our drinks, particularly our alcoholic drinks. You know, the beverage exports to the US, really, really big. The CSO says there's €681 million worth of beverage exports last year, presumably thanks to the likes of Guinness, Jameson, Bailey's, all those high-value whiskies that have become really, really popular in the past. So if there's suddenly a 10% levy attached to the price of those in the US, that's going to make them less attractive, of course, to American consumers. And they might start looking back towards their bourbon or American-made stouts instead. But it is worth noting as well, and this is something Sean alluded to, that the flip side of these tariffs, because anything Trump does will probably spark a retaliation by the European Union, because it is a two-way street. And that's potentially creating other problems for Irish consumers, because it runs the risk of stoking inflation, because if it's more expensive to buy a US product or you're relying on dearer European alternatives, suddenly the price of things starts to go up. And, you know, bear in mind, two of the three biggest imports from the US to the EU are crude oil and natural gas. So potentially we could have energy prices jumping again if there's a trade war, which then has a knock-on effect on everything else. It might even force the ECB to keep interest rates higher for longer than they're currently planning to do. I suppose maybe if there is a silver lining, if you can take one out of this, is that if there is this kind of trade war between the US and the EU, it could actually force some US firms to actually increase their operations in Europe, including in places like Ireland, as a way of getting around the tariffs. Because if they're making goods in the US and shipping them here, the tariffs might apply. But if they make them here in Europe and keep selling them in Europe, then they wouldn't actually apply. So it could actually be a workaround, probably, you know, a much smaller benefit than the loss of a trade war, but maybe something small that you can hold on to as a possible benefit.
Yeah, I mean, one of the people that could get caught in the crossfire of this is our old friends from Brexit times, the German car industry, because BMW and Volkswagen both have enormous operations in the continental United States from where they export production, including across to Europe. A lot of the BMW X series, the SUVs, they're made in Spartanburg, North Carolina, or is it South Carolina? Sorry, Carolina. Can't remember which one. I think it's South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And they get sent off to Europe. So how does somebody like that fare in a tariff situation? It's a German company, but it's a product made in America, but exported back to Europe. They could be in for a pretty awkward time. But the other thing to bear in mind is you may have the Trump administration proposing their plans, but you also have an army of lobbyists springing forth from a place called K Street here in the District of Columbia. And they will be working for these industries like the automotive, like the pharmaceutical, like the software, like banking and finance, and they are going to want to keep their happy situation going as long as they can. And that's where a lot of the negotiation, I think, will be done as well. It'll be between US industry and the administration to see what situation suits most of them most of the time to the best. And remember, it's not so much the tax rates that count, it's the tax regime. It's all the funny stuff that you can do in the background and all the details that nobody ever bothers to read except a few well-paid accountants. That's where the real secret sauce is. So tax rates are one thing, but it's the regime that allows you to move money between jurisdictions or hold off on payments for a protracted period of time. They're the things that US companies have benefited from, and you can be sure they're going to fight a really big rearguard action to hang on to them.
Adam, can we talk about tourism? Every corner of Ireland you go to, you find an American on holidays or on vacation, as they would say. It's a huge part of the industry here, and it's super important to Ireland. Does any of that change?
Well, I mean, potentially, yeah, it is hugely important. It has been for a long time, and more important now, actually, because in recent years, especially since Brexit, we've seen trips from British visitors decline and their length of stay decline, and the same with mainland Europe as well. They're spending less time on their trips here, but picking up the slack has been the North American visitor, which is, of course, in large part the US visitors. It figures from July to September this year, North American visitors were up 9%. The length of their stay was up 14% as well, so spending more time here. And that was worth €843 million to the Irish economy just in that 3 month period. And what you hear from people in the industry as well is that US visitors are particularly valuable because they spend a lot of money when they get here, and they don't just go to the big cities either. You know, they don't just stay in Dublin and Cork and Kilkenny maybe. Yeah. They travel around to every nook and cranny of the island. They really are a benefit to every small town and village.
Did you see the influencer Ballerina Farm recently on TikTok? Her and her family were in Cork. She's part of this like Mormon wife influencer thing that's happening at the moment,
and they were
all in, yes, and they were all in those small towns and villages, going to Ballymaloe, the cookery school there, and living life, I think, in an Airbnb on a farm. Like, surely that is that is beneficial, and that's the type of people that we're seeing coming here.
Yeah, absolutely, hugely valuable. Spend a lot of money and a lot of time as well, and you know, they go trace their family heritage all around the place and all that kind of stuff. But you know, the part of the reason why we've seen this pickup in US visitors lately is in large part thanks to the weakness of the euro against the dollar. You know, at one point many years ago, you were getting €1.60 to the dollar. Now we're close to parity. It's close to $1 to €1. And that means that when they come over here, their dollar goes a lot further when they spend it in Euroland and in Ireland. And, you know, maybe the silver lining of Trump is that at least since he's won the election, the dollar has gotten a bit stronger against the euro. It had started to weaken in recent months. It was up at about $1.12 to the euro. And now it's back down to €1.05. And this is a time of year as well when people will be booking their holidays. So maybe it's landed well for Ireland that people have a little bit more, you know, from their pocket money to be able to book a trip to Ireland. But you know, there's lots of, you know, domino effects here, because a healthy US tourism market is obviously contingent on the US economy being in good health, because, you know, once things start to sour domestically, people will, of course, rein in their spending on non-essentials, like, you know, a big trip back to the motherland to find their great-great-grandmother. Mm. And Donald Trump's efficiencies are, Elon Musk has warned that there will be a temporary hardship, including a probable overreaction in the economy, says, a market crash, as he starts to wield his axe on government spending. In other words, there'll be a recession. You know, he wants to take $2 trillion of spending out of the US economy. Many people question whether that's possible, but you know, even if he gets a fraction of that out, that represents lots of people losing their jobs in the US, lots of people getting pay cuts, and a lot less government money being pumped into states, into the private sector, which all has a knock-on effect on the country's economy. And if it does go into recession or even a slowdown, that could have a knock-on effect on tourism in Ireland.
It will definitely have a knock-on effect in tourism and every other sector of the economy. Again, the two-way nature of these things, the silver lining for the tourism industry back home, not such a silver lining when you're over here getting paid in euros and the... that'll tell you. But hey, I'll take a hit.
I think you mentioned this in every single podcast, Sean, about being paid in euro.
Keep sending the food parcels, Jackie. That's all I can say. And any of the big dairy companies, including, by the way, Glanbia, who operate 12 factories in 7 states making cheese over here. So, again, this is a huge investment by Irish companies. I think they're operating more factories here than they are in Ireland. So, you know, these things aren't two-way streets by any means. And you just got to watch the subtleties on these things. Obviously, at the moment, though, Trump is wielding a big stick, and he kind of likes it when people are a bit frightened and a bit on edge. And it's interesting looking at him rerunning the playbook of the first thing he does is go in and start beating up the Canadians and then the Mexicans, their two biggest trading partners, and then everybody else will suddenly fall into line, or so he hopes.
What we saw in the first term as well is that he likes to use tariffs as a negotiating tactic, and even you can see with the announcements made today that he was talking about fentanyl, and he was talking about, you know, illegal immigrants and all that kind of stuff, that he's basically saying, I'm going to apply these tariffs unless you give me what I want in this other area. And that may be what he does with Europe as well, is that he threatens to impose this tariff, or he does impose it, and then say, OK, now give me something I want, or give me favourable terms, and we'll get rid of the tariff then down the line. So it's kind of one of his tools of negotiation.
Well, listen, wrestling, baking and business, you've covered all your loves, Adam Maguire. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks. On States of Mind.
All right, cheers. Good to chat.
We have to have you back soon.
Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. And hopefully I'll be able to make the studio next time. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and get stuck into American football. Not all that nonsense with wrestling.
Oh, so let's bring in someone now to talk about some of those cabinet nominations by Donald Trump. Andrew McCabe, former deputy director of the FBI. Thank you so much for joining us on States of Mind today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, Andrew, can we talk about Donald Trump's cabinet picks? As I said, at the time of recording, we're hearing that Kash Patel may be nominated to lead the FBI. He's a former aide to President-elect Trump. He's never been directly employed by the FBI. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a confounding selection for many reasons. I should probably begin by saying that President-elect Trump certainly has the right to select any person he wants for these positions. That is, a constitutional function of our president in this country. And he'll pick the people that he thinks are best. But that doesn't mean that those selections are beyond the discussion and possibly criticism of the American electorate, right? And so that's really my concern about many of his picks, and certainly Kash Patel in any role in the FBI. As you've mentioned, he has no background in the FBI. He served in the Department of Justice as a line attorney in DOJ headquarters for just a couple of years on counterterrorism matters. And so he has some very minimal experience. But to my knowledge, Kash Patel has never occupied a leadership position really anywhere, or run or managed an institution or an organization of any type or any significant size at any point in his life. So that's a pretty significant lack of background and experience and expertise that's absolutely essential for the sorts of jobs that he's being talked about right now. And then, of course, I have many other concerns about the things that he's said about the FBI, the way he talks about FBI people, the very few statements that he's made about what he would do if he were placed in the FBI. I think all those comments really betray the fact that he doesn't really know anything about the FBI or its people or how we work or how we deploy our resources to protect the American people.
Why do you think, though, that experience is necessary to lead the FBI?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, it's a pretty big and complicated organization. It's 37,000 people who work all over the globe, mostly here in the United States, but we do have quite a few number of FBI personnel deployed overseas. We have 56 field offices in the United States. We have about another 350 locations in the United States that we work from. As the deputy director of the FBI, I had almost 80 direct reports to me, people whose progress and performance every year I was personally responsible for reviewing and working with them on. 80 is not the ideal number of direct reports in any organization. It's a massive, massive scope of authority. 56 of those people ran their own field offices. So it's a lot of work. And really the only way that I had any chance of succeeding in that role was because I'd spent my entire career in the FBI. I started as a special agent in 1996. I served in every level that an agent can serve in the Bureau. I'd had a number of very significant leadership positions before I became deputy director. And I feel like those things were all really essential. If I hadn't had that experience and wasn't able to bring that to the role, I would have been absolutely swamped.
What about any of the other national security picks? Tulsi Gabbard is a name that has cropped up quite a lot in terms of people having some national security concerns.
I think those concerns are well-founded. It's really extraordinary to have a nominee or an intended nominee to present the sort of questions and issues that she does. She has made numerous statements in the past several years that indicate her affinity for and kind of, allegiance to Russia and Vladimir Putin. It's a really bizarre thing to do for anyone in the intelligence community. It's the kind of thing that would actually provoke concern about that person's security clearance if they were already serving in the community. She's made some questionable decisions, I think, just my opinion, in the past in terms of traveling to Syria, visiting with Bashar al-Assad, an individual who is sanctioned by the United States as being essentially an enemy of the United States. I think there's a lot of really concerning questions there. She also has no experience in the intelligence community. And I think, much like Kash Patel, lacks any kind of significant leadership experience. The DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, is a large, complicated position. Their role is to really coordinate and bring all of the, 15 or so intelligence agencies in the United States intelligence community together to lead that community, to protect and encourage the work that they do. And I think many of the statements that she's made in the past and the way she's conducted herself have really raised questions about whether or not she's capable of doing that, and also whether or not she's inclined to support and protect and develop the intelligence community in the way that we need leaders to do that in light of the many national security threats that we face today.
If she gets through on the process, the scrutiny process on this, what kind of information would the Director of National Intelligence have access to? I mean, would they get to see the crown jewels? Would they be able to look for the sourcing on information, or would the agencies be quite protective of their material and their assets?
Well, technically, the DNI is entitled to see everything, anything they want. Any intelligence that's necessary, to understand and speak to the most significant, serious, deadly threats that we face. The DNI is essentially the president's intelligence provider, right? The DNI comes over and presides over the morning intelligence briefing to the president, presents the PDB, the infamous presidential daily brief. That's the highly, highly sensitive, top secret, compartmented information report that is prepared specifically for the president to keep the president up to speed on those issues. The DNI oversees that process of producing that report every day or a few times a week, however often the president wants it. So to have someone in that role who doesn't really know the community, has no experience with intelligence, and has indicated, quite frankly, a suspicion and a lack of confidence and trust in the community is really very questionable pick, I think. And it says a lot about how little I think Donald Trump relies on intelligence, and how little he doesn't really prioritize intelligence and the production of intelligence to him on a regular basis on an effective way. I think, any president would see the DNI as the person that they absolutely need to keep them apprised of the nation's most serious business. So typically they tend to pick a proven professional who they trust and rely on. And this pick seems kind of inconsistent with that approach.
The buildup to the war in Ukraine, intelligence became a critical issue and an instrument of diplomacy, indeed, in the months and weeks leading into that conflict. I wonder about what you think a Tulsi Gabbard figure in that role might have made of the build-up to war in Ukraine. But also this phrase, the deep state, that's something that I think she's been critical of. Kash Patel has. A lot of people in Trump world speak about the deep state and trying to root them out and clean them out. Do you think these are the reasons behind appointments that are just way outside of the system, like Gabbard or indeed Pete Hegseth, nominated at Defense?
Yeah, so let me speak to the first part of your question first, because I think it's an excellent example of exactly why these picks, and the DNI pick is so important. So the intelligence we were able to collect as the Russians prepared to invade Ukraine was absolutely essential. Really amazing collection. And it's important to note that we made a strong departure from the way we normally handle that information. The Biden administration very pointedly declassified some of the most sensitive intelligence we had for the purpose of making it public so that the world could understand the enormity of the threat that Russia posed, and also to counteract the disinformation and the lies that the Russians were making about their own intentions. So really bold decisions made there by the DNI and the president at the time. And so it shows you how critically important that role is. Now, her comments about Russia's intents, her basically history of essentially favoring Russia in this conflict with Ukraine, I think, you know, draws a spotlight on some of the things that certainly need to be pushed on and she needs to be questioned about during a confirmation hearing, if in fact her nomination goes that far. Your question about the deep state is a good one. This is a, again, it's my opinion, it's still worth what you paid for it, but this is a fiction that's been created by politicians and political people to kind of vilify government and people who work in government and people who spend their careers dedicated simply to helping their nation and their community by serving in government. It's not a real thing. It doesn't exist. But nevertheless, it's become a bit of a litmus test, I think, in that political community, particularly the one created by Donald Trump. And so, yeah, I think these people who are, I don't think anyone really has a chance of being selected or nominated for one of these positions unless they've kind of proven their mettle to Donald Trump on that point. They have to be very outspoken kind of critics of and, you know, cast themselves as warriors against this infamous deep state, which really raises, I think, significant concerns about how they intend to follow through on these jobs. If you're coming into an organization with no plan, no philosophy, no ideology other than burn it all down, destroy it, kick the people out, like Kash Patel has said that he's going to take the 7,000 people who work at FBI headquarters and send them off around the country to work as police officers. I guess no one told him that 6,000 of those people are not actually law enforcement officers. But nevertheless, I think to me, it just exposes the lack of suitability, as far as I'm concerned, of most of these people.
Just finally, Andrew, because you're raising concerns about Tulsi Gabbard due to her ties with Russia, but Donald Trump has ties to Russia and a relationship with President Vladimir Putin.
He does. He absolutely does. I think those concerns have been well known about Donald Trump for a long time. Of course, he denies those associations, but yet they persist. I think most of those questions have never been fully investigated and resolved in any significant and impartial way. But nevertheless, he's been elected president. And so kind of, you know, the voters have spoken, and I guess you could interpret his victory at least in one way, to mean that the people who elected him aren't really concerned about his connections mm-hmm. to Russia, which is an interesting way to think about someone serving as president. But nevertheless, that judgment has been made. And now we're kind of seeing, the second and third order effects of that selection in the people that Donald Trump is surrounding himself with, people who quite naturally hold opinions similar to him on issues like Russia and how our government and our intelligence community should function in our efforts to, to counter the efforts of really what is arguably our most significant enemy, certainly one of the top two or three in the world. So we'll see. We'll see how that works out.
Andrew McCabe, former Deputy Director of the FBI, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Finally, three things to know in 30 seconds. Watch for the fallout from Donald Trump's announcement that he would impose 25% tariffs on all products coming into the US from Canada, Mexico and China on his first day in office. When we're back, it'll be December. This is number two. For that month, the US will assume the presidency of the UN Security Council. And Sean, what's number three?
Number three, it's Thanksgiving Day on Thursday here in the United States. No turkey is safe. Have a good one, people.
Only the one that Joe Biden pardons. There you go. Chat to you in 2 weeks, Sean.
See you, Jackie.